The title of this book is Lutie Goes to Heaven by Amy Ching Yan Lam. The book cover is black, with the title in cyan blue, in both English and traditional Chinese. There are two decorative white shapes that look like flowers or stars near the title. The cover has a circle cutout that reveals a pencil drawing of a sleeping dog's face. Upon opening the cover, the whole drawing is revealed, which is a dog sleeping in front of a tombstone that says Lutie. Lutie Goes to Heaven. A dog was taken by British troops during the looting of the Summer Palace, the Yuan Ming Yuan, in Beijing near the end of the Second Opium War in 1860. She was gifted to Queen Victoria and renamed Lutie. Lutie was one of five Pekingese dogs that were taken from the Yuan Ming Yuan. They were the first of the breed to be brought to England. Lutie lived for 11 years at Windsor Castle in Sandringham House. She died in 1872. The Opium Wars made Hong Kong into a British colony. The English word loot comes from the Hindi, adopted during the British colonization of India. 1. When Lutie died, it began as a pulling motion. She felt her organs being stretched into a thin, elastic string, a buoyancy from her tail to her nose, then a gentle bouncing, like being rocked. The bouncing increased in frequency and shrunk in height until it was a humming that vibrated in a sharp core in her body. Then the sharpness increased until her insides became a blade, with infinite edges that cut on all sides, and as the blade increased in length, so did she, and the cutting was simultaneous and imperceptible. The gate to heaven was a perfectly round hole in a thicket of thorny bushes. There was only one small twig that disturbed the perfect circle. Lutie started moving closer, but a person wearing a tall silk hat with two quivering antennae stepped out of the hole. They snipped the twig with a pair of shining scissors. Then the person turned to look at her. A very flat, round, green face was surrounded by long, black, messy hair. Crimson eyes pointed down at a low, round nose with big nostrils. The hat's antennae left faint, glowing trails in the air as they waved. Lutie yelped, and in making the noise, realized that she was now a kind of cloud. She felt sensitive all over, like her whole body was a nose. She could feel her yelp reverberate through the air, which was also her body, and it was both pleasurable and scary. The green-faced person, without taking their red eyes off of Lutie, began to rummage through their many pockets, shrugging their arms in and out of many different sleeves. It seemed like their robe had an infinite number of sleeves and pockets, covered in many tiny patches stitched evenly by hand. Inside some of the pockets were nuts, others had needles and bundles of thread, others had miniature light bulbs, and others had rolled up scrolls. Lutie, to her embarrassment, started whining. The green-faced person brought their finger up to their mouth and went, "Shh." Their voice was low and gravelly, and the sound rippled through Lutie. They said, "The other name for heaven is hell." Then they pulled out a scroll that was tied with a stained, baby blue ribbon and tugged it loose. The scroll unfurled towards Lutie, one end coming to rest exactly in front of Lutie's paw, making it tingle. 2. Lutie was born at the first palace in the midst of several concurrent wars. Because it was a palace, her home remained removed from most of the destruction and suffering. There was a village right outside the grounds, but few villagers ever came inside. Lutie's mother and the other dogs reminisced about how, before this latest war, they would get daily massages and meals fed by hand, but their complaints didn't affect Lutie. She spent most of her time in one of the libraries. In her favorite corner of the culinary section, she laid behind a stool that held a dusty sculpture of a large Celtic spear. It was carved of a milky, light green stone, and she studied it for so long that she understood its personality. Her mother tried to encourage Lutie to join in on games, especially the begging contest where they would try to see who could get the most treats out of the caretakers, but Lutie didn't like the possibility of getting yelled at by an annoyed person. So, between the Celtic spear, the pond, and her bed, Luti made sure she was completely occupied. But when Moon arrived, Luti found that she was actually desperately and deliciously unsatisfied. It was autumn, the mushrooms pushing out through the sludge. Moon was deposited one morning in one of the dog rooms by a caretaker. She had been gifted to the palace by a merchant seeking favor for the purpose of being bred. She had a little spot of black between her eyes that rhymed with spots of black on the top of her feet, and she moved in a way that hinted at a spirit for escape. Moon saw Luti from across the room and came over like she knew exactly what she was doing. Luti had never had that kind of plain attention before. Luti brought Moon to the Celta spear and felt pure joy when Moon jumped up to lick the dust off the tip. They slept with their feet on top of each other. 3. Back then, Luti's name was not Luti, it was Flower Bud, but Luti didn't like it. She felt it was only assigned to her because of the rule that all the dogs were to be named after beautiful, precious things. Moon said, "I think it suits you, but what would you prefer instead?" "I don't know, what about Stinky Wind Tormentor?" Luti replied. Moon laughed because Stinky Wind was what all the dogs called the Emperor. His rich meals made him constantly gassy, which he tried to hide with perfume, and he was full of fake affection. The dogs would mentally prepare themselves whenever he entered their rooms. During one of his visits, he cooed extravagantly over Moon, which gave her the excuse to follow him around, jumping up and biting his face over and over until he couldn't keep up the pretense anymore and had to throw Moon off of him in disgust. Moon then skipped around the room, licking her lips with great relish and making eye contact with the other dogs, really stretching her tongue out to make them laugh, until one of them, Cinnabar, lost control of her bladder in a delirium. Moon got away with doing stuff like that because she was a breeding dog. She had fur on her ears that reached all the way down to the floor, while Luti stopped growing after a certain length. She was constantly being fed different meal plans, and measured, and fed a new plan, and measured again. The caretakers were especially obsessed with assessing her shit. They would pick it up constantly and peer into it like they were looking for messages. Moon's first litter was the easiest, and her fourth the hardest. The dog caretakers removed 2 out of the 5 puppies from the fourth because they deemed them to be weak. Moon cried for days afterwards, a cry that was small and high-pitched. Each of Moon's living 28 children were given official names, and Luti and Moon also gave them nicknames that were more appropriate for their generally annoying personalities. The 4 that died were named secretly by Moon. She didn't tell anyone else their names. 4. The day that the British and French troops broke into the palace, Luti and Moon had been hiding for several weeks already. The Emperor had left for the season a few months ago, as usual, but then almost all of the attendants and caretakers disappeared one day as well. Most of them took dogs along with them to sell, including all of Moon's children. There were only a couple of guards left, and they were not so much patrolling as nervously darting around the grounds, whispering theories about why the barbarians were so touchy. One caretaker, who was devoted to the dogs, stayed behind and put food out for them, but there was less of it every day. "When do you think we should go?" Luti asked. "So we are going to the village?" Moon replied. The quiet arguing was interrupted by loud laughter and the stomping of boots down the hall. The laughter and stomping paused in front of the library, and the vase at the entrance clattered to the floor. A strange metallic smell filled the air. Moon and Luti stopped breathing. After a moment, the boots moved away, but then, in their bellies, they felt the distant vibration of many more boots. Luti looked at Moon to see what to do. She understood Moon's expression, saying, "It's going to be okay, we have to go, let's go now." Moon darted out from the bookcase and Luti followed, and they ran as fast as they could, out from the library, down the hallway, towards the gardens, towards the exterior walls. As they were running through the courtyard, Luti spotted the caretaker, her clothing all disheveled and eyes wild, running towards them. She hesitated, which made Moon slow down too. When Moon saw Luti looking at the caretaker, she cried, "No!" But Luti's hesitation allowed the caretaker to catch up. The caretaker looked at them both and decided to make a grab for Moon. She managed to get a hold of Moon's tail and lift her up, Moon screaming. Then Luti saw Moon struggling in the caretaker's arms, and then the caretaker sprinting towards the gates to a meeting hall, and then appearing from around a corner, a tall man in a red jacket and white pants chasing the two of them. Luti stayed frozen underneath the Emperor's bed beside the piss pot, her mind completely blank, ruled by nothing, until she was dragged out by her hind legs. The man in the red jacket who pulled her out chuckled and gripped her tightly in his arms, his metallic smell suffocating. He marched her past the rooms of the palace, in which at least half of everything had been smashed and laid in bits on the floor. She was brought outside to one of the great halls, where there was a swarm of men in red jackets, a couple of them standing on top of a lacquer table beside a giant pile of unsmashed things, screens, chairs, wall hangings, sculptures, furs, scrolls, jars, jewelry, bolts of silk. All the things that represented power and mastery, the incense burner that shaped smoke into a thousand twirling strands, a book of paintings on silk, depicting scenes from a play about a love affair at the end of a dynasty, maybe the Celta's spear, even a clock that had been gifted to the emperor by a British lord. All of it was now this heap, about to be dissolved into cash. To celebrate, some of the red-jacketed men had wrapped furs around their necks and were dancing and waggling their arms. Others were pointing and clapping along. Someone called out to the man who was clutching her, "I bid 500 for the dog, ha ha." The man holding Luti snorted and kept walking. A bowl fell off someone's head and bounced once on the floor. 5. There were 4 other dogs in the wooden cage, but none of them were Moon. Luti cried so much on the long boat journey that she felt inside out. Her interior was all dry and parched, but her exterior all wet and bloody. One night, a man brought her out on deck and held her out over the water. He said, "Look at this, little doggie. This is the ocean. Now stop crying, little bitch." Luti felt the glimmering expanse. It sucked at her from all sides. One of the other dogs in the cage was Cinnabar. She was the goofiest out of all the palace dogs, with 2 moods, either 100% frenzied or nearly comatose. This was because she was profoundly devoted to one of the caretakers. In the caretaker's absence, Cinnabar would just lie there, her head on her paws, eyes open and unblinking. But when the caretaker returned, Cinnabar would shake with excitement and chase a piece of dust around the room for hours, captivated by her own passion. In the cage, she shook so hard that the boards started rattling, adding to the already intolerable din. Cinnabar looked at the other dogs and said, "I'm sorry, I'm really sorry," still shaking. Luti moved over to wrap her body around hers and wiped her tears on the back of her neck. 6. Back at the gate to heaven, Luti watched a hedgehog waddle its way through the hole in the thicket. Before she could go in, she had to give the green-faced person a true account of her life. The green-faced person said, in their gravelly voice, "It can be as short or as long as you like. The only condition is that it must be absolutely true." The green-faced person said, "True in the sense that it is what will be forgotten. Once it is written down on the scroll, then you will forget it." The antennae on their hat gave a tiny wave at the conclusion of this statement. "Or, actually, we will all forget it. I will forget it too," they added. Luti watched a white rat, 3 millipedes, a hairless cat, a pufferfish, and now this hedgehog, all in the form of shivering clouds, give their true accounts, while she sat there, stuck. It seemed very unfair that she had to determine at this moment what her account would be, when so many other things had been determined for her, and that it would all be forgotten, and also that there was no one else here to help her remember or forget, when how could anything be remembered or forgotten without someone else? And what if she left something or someone out of this true and final account? Would that something or someone be lost forever? Would the something or someone she left out be so lost that the effects would travel through time to hurt or diminish what she could not remember in this moment? And, to make it even worse, everyone had started the true account of their life with their true name, and she did not think hers was either Luti or Flowerbud. The green-faced person watched the back of the hedgehog until it disappeared entirely into the thicket and said, "You can keep thinking about it for a little while longer, but you can't stay here forever." The green-faced person sat down on the worn dimple of a rock. They pulled out a nut from one of their pockets and started nibbling on it, and rifled through another sleeve until they found a small, salmon-colored plastic clock. They turned its dials with their long fingers while holding it in the same hand, narrowing their eyes to make sure the time was correct. 7. When Luti met the queen for the first time, she took the opportunity to be a little bit sick. The man awkwardly held Luti up in front of him while kneeling in front of the queen, and with the man's hand squeezing her belly like that, it was easy to gag and spit up a little bit over herself. The man apologized, and the queen acted like she didn't mind while Luti got wiped down by a servant. Then the man told the queen the story of how they had stumbled upon Luti and four other dogs on the verge of getting their throats cut by a sobbing imperial consort in one of the private quarters of the Chinese palace, and had rescued them, just in time, leaving the consort to slit her own throat. The man said, "They would rather kill them than let us have them." The queen replied, "What an interesting little dog." Then the queen said, "Her name, from now on, is Luti, to commemorate your men's bravery and daring." And she gingerly picked Luti up and examined the long fur on her paws, cooing just enough. Then the man gave the queen the emperor's cap, covered with small beaded figures, and a jade-covered accordion book of a Buddhist sutra. The queen admired the objects, with Luti still in her lap, and the man left, pleased. Then the queen put Luti down on the floor, making Luti gag again, the sound of which brought one of the servants over to pick her up and take her away. There was a warm, yeasty smell to this palace that overwhelmed Luti as she was carried through the hallways. The men in red jackets were everywhere. Luti couldn't stop thinking about the red-jacketed man running towards Moon and the caretaker, and how she had hesitated, and what must have happened next. She gagged again at the plate of oatmeal mash and meat broth that was put down in front of her, and the servant didn't bother trying to coax her to eat any of it. In the middle of the night, she woke startled from a dream where she was in a tiled room and she was trying to get out, but when she pawed at the tiles, they disintegrated under her nails. They were made with an old, powdery cake that was very sweet, and that, even if she scratched it away, regenerated itself. 8. Luti wondered if being renamed had changed something inside her, because she felt different, like something had been lodged inside her, some kind of pointy irritant that shifted uncomfortably with movement. She tried to distract herself by scratching at a big bald spot that had appeared on her belly, worrying at it with her tongue, the soreness occupying her body so that she didn't have to think about anything else. The spot grew and grew, getting more and more raw, leaking a layer of pus that dried into a crust that she licked away too. The dog caretakers tried to keep her from it by putting a horrible tasting ointment on her belly, but Luti was not deterred. They said, "Poor thing," and cooed at her at first, but as she kept on doing it, they became more impatient, a bit disgusted by her, which was a small victory for Luti, because she hated how they treated her like she was so pathetic, so sad, and assumed she was so homesick. As she licked her belly, Luti thought about how Moon had been good at outwardly putting up with her caretaker's experiments, but how sometimes her act would fall apart. Luti would put some of her own meals aside to give to Moon when they changed her diet. But once in a while, Moon sulked and refused what Luti had saved. She would insult Luti by saying that she had a special diet because she was special, and not all the dogs were special like her, and then turn her back to her. Luti had felt completely lost when Moon was in these bad moods. She would immediately start going over all of her weaknesses and faults, certain that Moon's unhappiness would destroy them both. She would sit there, trapped in her helplessness, unable to console Moon, and also acutely aware of this inability, which made her even more helpless, which was like the state she was in now, circling around herself in a frozen, swirling orbit. 9. Luti started a fantasy where she had her own palace all to herself. She was the empress of the palace, and she had to build the palace and its grounds all from scratch and in her head, so she had to spend all of her time working on it. She started with a few buildings at first, thinking about their shape and size and materials, and then plotted out the gardens and ponds and bridges and paths, the flowers and shrubs and trees, and then added more buildings, and then the interiors of the buildings, the rooms and their furnishings and decorations. No one else lived in this palace. It was empty except for her. It was filled with the perfect, undisturbed harmony of objects. Every time Luti returned to working on it, she would first refresh herself by surveying every part of what had already been made, every detail that she had decided upon, which took longer and longer as she kept building it. She didn't want to forget any part of it, which was surprisingly hard, even though it was her own fantasy, she had made it all up. 10. The caretakers would speculate about what Luti's life at the first palace had been like. They had heard fascinating stories about Chinese torture and executions, and they concluded that Luti's life must have been filled with incredible cruelty. One of them exclaimed, "Look at her flat little nose." Another one wondered, "I wonder how her face got so flat," which turned into the story that she had been bonked on the wall repeatedly as a baby to make her face so flat. This was repeated amongst the caretakers until they got bored of it. The fact of the bonked one, as boring as all the other facts. Luti forced herself to respond to her new name quickly so that the caretakers would leave her alone. The next time Luti met the queen was at a special tea with the queen's daughter-in-law, the princess, some consorts, and a visiting gentleman from China who had been presented to the royals as a mandarin but was actually an opium trader. He had helped make some British opium traders and in the process, himself, very rich. The servants laid out a spread of tea, sandwiches, and cakes and put a little red bow on the top of Luti's head and a couple of jingling bells around her neck. She was brought into the room on a little pillow of yellow silk, which had been custom made for her out of silk taken from the first palace, and everybody smiled when she entered. The caretaker presented her first to the Chinese man. In his lap, Luti could tell he wasn't especially interested in her. His body was alert and aimed towards the queen, but he still made a show of saying "good doggy" in English and then in Cantonese. The queen murmured appreciatively at the foreign language. Then he passed her to the princess, who exclaimed, "Poor thing, what a sweet little thing," and pat her all over, kissing her nose over and over. "She must be so lonely, coming from so far away." The princess started asking the Chinese man a series of questions about the Pekingese breed. What were they fed at the palace? What gave them their special walk? Was only the emperor allowed to touch them? Was anybody else outside of the royal palace allowed to buy or breed them? At first, the opium trader didn't know what to say. He hadn't been expecting an interrogation about small dogs. On his way over, he actually had been worrying about using the correct English word for foreigner. The Chinese character that meant both foreigner and barbarian had been outlawed by the British in China. So he wasn't sure what was acceptable in English, and he was scared he'd use an inappropriate word in front of the queen, revealing himself. But, seeing the greedy interest in the princess's face and the corresponding disinterest in the queen's, he quickly realized he could say anything he wanted about dogs. So he talked for as long as he could, repeating the few things he had heard about the emperor's pets and fluffing them up with anecdotes about other random dogs he had met throughout his life. He mixed up imperial decrees with dog personalities, Manchu traditions with basic pet care, until he confused himself. Thankfully, he had a story saved for the end of his rambling, one he had heard before, about how the Pekingese was the result of a lion falling in love with a marmoset. The Buddha had granted the lovers their wish by shrinking the lion down to the marmoset size. The opium trader added, "The Buddha didn't make the marmoset lion-sized because the rest of the animals thought, and the Buddha agreed that it would be too creepy." This last tale pleased the princess so much, she gave Luti another long kiss on the forehead and said, "It would be so cute if she had a little husband with her own little family." Luti, for the most part, had been looking at a tapestry hanging on the wall that had a dragon flying through one corner of the sky. The dragon was rainbow-colored with a long tail that looped around itself and ended in a curlicue. Its back was arched, its teeth bared, its chin and nose hair streaming in the wind. It looked like it was flying up directly towards the edge of the tapestry to break through the surface between the picture and the room. But when the princess said, "family," Luti reflexively dug her nails into the princess's thighs, which made the princess nearly drop her cup of tea. She then pinched Luti hard, which made Luti squeal and jump out of her lap directly onto a platter of prune cakes. The nasty cakes squished between her toes and she hopped out of them onto a consort's lap, knocking over the tower of liver pate and sweet pickle sandwiches, which fell onto the giant teapot, making it crash to the floor. The consort let out a guttural yell and shoved Luti off of her taffeta skirts, and Luti landed belly up in the slurry of sugar, liver, and tea that oozed a path across the floor. The queen pretended like nothing had happened, and the Chinese visitor tried to follow suit, but his face showed that he hoped what the Chinese dog had done wouldn't be used against him later. The princess was furious for a moment, but then said, "Of course, she's not properly trained." And as the servants rushed in to clean up and remove Luti, she asked the opium trader, "Could you find me a stud so I can have some of my own?" After the tea, Luti was sent by the queen to live with the princess at a different palace. 11. Every time Luti went over her true account at the gate to heaven, she found a new reason to be dissatisfied with it. Either she forgot something, or got something wrong, or she remembered something that she wished she had done differently and so didn't know how to tell. The salmon clock dinged, indicating to the green-faced person that it was time to reveal to Luti the other option. Across from the hole in the thicket, down a bit of a slope, was a deep pit carved out of a dusty red clay. The edges of the pit were sharp, and it was filled with darkness, but there was a slight flickering in the center of the darkness. The green-faced person said, "At the bottom of that pit is a pool of bright yellow water, which is a way out of heaven. If you are unable to give your true account, then you will have to take that path to go back." The green-faced person ran their long fingers through a knot in their hair and added, "Approximately 32% of all creatures decide to go back, and about half of those who do end up back here again." "What happens to the ones who don't come back here?" Luti asked. "They get stuck," the green-faced person said, "which is sometimes what is needed." 12. Back at the palace, Luti dreaded the arrival of every new dog, worried it was going to be a mate for her, but the opium trader never returned to visit them again. The princess was exasperated because even with extra training, the Chinese dog remained very unfriendly, but she soon had reason to forget about Luti after she was gifted a spaniel from Russia. One winter, Waldina, a Dachshund, gave birth to a litter of 5 puppies. Unlike what had happened to Moon's children at the first palace, puppies that were diagnosed as weak here were not removed by the caretakers, but they were also not given any extra care or support. Instead, they were expected to figure out their own survival. The litter had 2 puppies that needed a bit more attention, but the caretakers steadfastly gave all of them the same amount of milk and warmth until one of them died. The other, named Waldina after her mother, was quiet and stayed on the periphery of everything, and Luti grew attached to her. Waldina the mother babied her, and was glad to see Luti take an interest, and so Luti took on the role of being another caretaker. Waldina the second would bring Luti outside and describe to her the exact nature of a breeze as it blew over them. She could name what kinds of trees and animals and water it had touched. Waldina was also deeply bloodthirsty. Luti would often find her with her nose stuck between some furniture and a wall, inhaling deeply in the direction of a mouse hole that she could not reach. She alternated between deep huffs and a desperate whine, and she would only be satisfied after she had fully dismembered and eaten the mouse and was nuzzling a scrap of gray fur. Luti said to Waldina II, "Your name is ridiculous." Waldina pouted. "It's not that bad." "You need a different name," Luti said. "I think it should be Gust, like the wind." "LOL, sure," Waldina said. Luti developed new fears as she got older, specifically of heights and of reflections of herself in polished surfaces. She tripped over herself in a hallway when she caught a glimpse of what she thought was a dead dog in the center of a new silver plate acquired by the princess. Luti remembered the first time she had told Moon that she was scared and how hard it had been to do. It was after Moon had been poked at by a caretaker. She had been mean to Luti all day. They were sitting together uncomfortably by the pond, Luti tracing the scum with her paw, upset and spinning, feeling like she was going to explode. She had to force out a whisper, "I'm just scared." It sounded so stupid and obvious out loud that she laughed a bit afterwards. But then Moon burst into tears. Luti naming it had made Moon realize how she felt too. Without Luti, she wouldn't have recognized it. Their love had been this recognition of sameness and difference in each other and themselves. Now Luti tried to keep this recognition inside her, but it was hard to do because it strained to get out. 13. At the gate to heaven, the green-faced person washed each scroll on which a true account had been written with a little rag in a porcelain dish of water. The red ink floated off the parchment, the words intact but distorting in the water's movement. The green-faced person then poured the water into the mouth of a funnel stuck in the ground. The water and words fell into the funnel and through a twisted pipe, splashing out into a big underground reservoir whose walls were stained red, where the ink slowly decomposed. 14. What did it mean to be a dog? Did it mean being an object of pity? Did it mean being a sponge for excess feelings? Did it mean being a receptacle, a measure of other creatures' capacity for affection, a creature used to test questions of how much can I love, or how much love do I deserve? Or, conversely, did it mean being a radiant source of feeling? Did it mean being a creature that produced unlimited empathy and love in others, that created the possibilities of commitment? A creature that generated true reciprocity, as in shared effects, shared consequences, shared significance? Near the end of Luti's life, she was reunited with Cinnabar. When Luti had been gifted to the queen, Cinnabar had been gifted to a duchess. The duchess was invited over for tea, but Cinnabar was no longer the same dog that Luti had known. Upon arriving in the garden, she was reluctant to acknowledge Luti, and Luti had to chase after her, rounding her up near a hedge to confirm that it was her. They were both old dogs now, but Cinnabar's eyes were dull. She greeted Luti, but didn't hold her gaze. Luti made a shy comment about a plant in the garden she liked, which Cinnabar ignored. After a long, painful silence, Cinnabar finally said, "How do you deal with it? You seem happy." Luti withered. She didn't know what to say. Cinnabar then told Luti that she had been sent to the Duchess with Pillow, another dog from the first palace. Luti remembered that Pillow had been a bit younger than her mother, and the day that Luti's mother had died, he had given Luti a peck on the forehead. Cinnabar said that Pillow passed away a few months after arriving. He never recovered from the journey. "Pillow was really sweet," Cinnabar said. They sat there, silent again. Luti couldn't help but picture herself dead. What if she had died after arriving at the palace? She pictured the queen looking at her dead body. Then Cinnabar unleashed about how much she hated her home, how she had hated it from the start. The smells, the textures, the energy of the people, all of it was horrible. They had renamed her Gu, a fake Chinese word, which made no sense, and she was allergic to everything. Everything made her itchy and sore. The Duchess barely paid any attention to her, only liked to show her off at functions, and instead doted on her other dog, a staghound. "And he's a fucking idiot," Cinnabar said. "He's jealous of me for no reason." A raven landed on the hedge and looked at them. It was almost bigger than Luti, with a burnt smell and black feathers that glowed blue. Cinnabar started barking, but the raven pretended to ignore her, which only made Cinnabar more angry and bark more. She barked and barked until she was hoarse, and then she had to leave. Afterwards, Luti wandered around in circles, unable to be still. She thought, "Cinnabar is so fucked up," and then she felt bad for thinking that, but it kept repeating in her head. The sun sunk behind a stand of trees. The big summer blooms were fully wilted, the petals dissolving into slime. In the kennels, Gust asked Luti what had happened. Luti had never told Gust or any other dog at this palace the whole story before, with all the difficult parts, and she wasn't sure if she wanted to do it now. She had imagined telling Gust at some point when she was older, after she had a chance to organize it in a neater way, with a clear lesson. Gust asked, "So what happened to your friend?" Luti said, "She was the most devoted dog," and started explaining how Cinnabar used to be at the first palace. But Gust's attention wandered for a second, her eyes following a fly, and it confirmed for Luti that it wasn't the right time. She would have to continue to wait. She told Gust to go away and burrowed her face into her straw bed. Luti imagined a time that would be right, a faraway time, filled with spinning stars. 15. When Luti died, she was sleeping. No one noticed until the following morning. Gust cried hard for her, and the other dogs bowed their heads. Gust never understood why Luti hadn't told her more about the first palace. She could only assume a life of pure opulence and bliss, the most exceptional and strange luxuries, a world of amazing texture. Luti was buried on the palace grounds. Gust marked the spot by writing Luti's name with her nose. 16. Back at the gate to heaven, Luti pictured what it would be like to go back to Earth. She pictured her cloud self passing through the yellow pool, being chilled by the yellow water. She pictured coming out the other side as smoke from a fire and snaking through the air in long, lazy swoops towards the palace of the queen. She pictured dropping down through a chimney, coming out above the licking flames, slipping through the hallways and under the queen's bedroom door, then gliding around the periphery of the room towards the bed, sliding under its foot, and curling back up towards the queen's head, floating above the head resting on the satin pillow, until the queen felt the chill and opened her eyes with a sharp inhale, then darting into the queen's ear and settling there. The queen calling her doctors and priests and all of them completely confused about her earache. The queen unable to focus on anything else, becoming possessed by the mysterious cold pain. Then, one day, leaving, without the queen ever knowing what had happened. But before leaving, whispering a message for her to share with all the other queens and kings and emperors and empresses. Luti then pictured her cloud self splitting up into a crowd of many smaller clouds. Each cloud raw and sticky. Each cloud catching onto something. A flapping curtain, a tuft of fur, the bottom of a shoe. Each is filled with relief at no longer having to be unique and can't be shaken loose. Luti then tried to picture what was on the other side of the gate to heaven. Timeline. Many parts of the story are based on true events. The following is a timeline that partially covers the causes and effects of the Opium Wars, the popularization of Pekingese dogs in Britain, and the tea trade in Birmingham. 1839. The first Opium War begins. The war is lobbied for by British merchants who have been smuggling vast quantities of opium into China in order to purchase tea and other goods at profitable margins. The merchants demand free, unfettered access to Chinese markets and oppose the Qing government's actions towards stopping the opium trade. The opium is grown by peasant farmers in British-controlled India, who are forced to do so at a loss. During the 1800s, opium was one of the most significant products in global trade. Historians argue that opium was the product that made the British Empire one on which the sun never set. 1842. China is defeated militarily, and the British merchants prevail as Chinese control of the trade system is abolished in the Treaty of Nanjing. Another major concession is that the island of Hong Kong becomes property of the British. 1842 to 1856, the word loot comes into common usage between the First and Second Opium Wars. Unlike pillage and plunder, it specifically refers to the adventure and profit available to enterprising soldiers in colonial expeditions. 1845. Queen Victoria is gifted a chow chow, or a Chinese edible dog, as they were known at the time. 1856. the Second Opium War begins. 1860. An auction of looted objects from the Summer Palace, Yuanming Yuan, is held on its grounds by British troops. The auction follows British prize law, which legalizes and organizes looting through the record-keeping and division of sales to soldiers. The palace is later destroyed by the British troops, justified as retaliation for the Chinese treatment of some British soldiers, including those from an Indian regiment. The burning of villages adjacent to the palace gardens is also mentioned in a few historical accounts. After China is defeated again this year, the Tianjin Treaty is signed and part of Kowloon, adjacent to Hong Kong, is ceded to the British. Another treaty provision is the banning of the Chinese character Yi, which the British translate as barbarian, but could also be translated as foreigner. The British perceive this word to be insulting. 1862. Luti is photographed by William Bambridge. Of the four other Pekingese dogs brought to England, two are gifted to the Duchess of Richmond, and the other two kept by Lord John Hay. Looted objects from the Summer Palace are shown at the International Exhibition of 1862. 1863. John Sumner of Birmingham publishes a popular treatise on tea, which opens with an epigraph from the poem Charity by William Cowper. The bond of commerce was designed to associate all the branches of mankind, and if a boundless plenty be the robe, trade is the golden girdle of the globe. 1865. A system of indentured labor is introduced to the fledgling tea industry in British-controlled Assam, India, which enables the mass relocation of workers to this remote region. They are bound by highly restrictive penal contracts, which criminalize non-compliance through prison, forced labor, and other punishments. These are part of a body of legislation called Master and Servant Laws, used throughout the British Empire. Assam becomes a major tea-producing region of the world, and in the following three decades, colonial Indian tea production surpasses the Chinese industry. 1891. The first Crufts Dog Show is held at the Royal Agricultural Hall in Islington. Around 2,000 dogs are entered, including some Pomeranians of Queen Victoria's. 1892. Birmingham Dogs Home, a dog welfare charity, is founded on land donated by Sir Alfred Gooch Bart on New Canal Street in the Digbeth neighborhood, on the plot of land that will later become the site of the Taifu Tea Factory. The Gooches are one of the primary landowners in Digbeth and Southside Birmingham. 1898, additional land known as the New Territories near Kowloon and Hong Kong is leased to the British for a 99-year term, expiring June 1997. 1899. Francis Galton, the lead proponent of eugenics, participates in the Crystal Palace Dog Show of 1899, taking standardized photos of champion dogs. Galton was born in Birmingham, of a prominent family that made its wealth from weapons manufacturing. His theory of eugenics proposes that talent runs in families and that human reproduction should be managed to eliminate weaknesses. His ideas were deeply wrong, but Galton saw himself as proof of them because Charles Darwin was his cousin. 1900. Beijing and the surrounding province are looted by British and other foreign troops after the repression of the Boxer Uprising, an anti-Christian, anti-Western Chinese popular movement. Described as a carnival of loot, the looting lasts several months and Western markets are flooded with Chinese art objects. 1901. Lady Gooch of the Gooch Estate is photographed with a Pekingese named Pekin Yen at a Pekingese dog event for aristocratic women. At this time, the Pekingese is a very fashionable lapdog. 1903. John Sumner founds the Taifu Tea brand in Birmingham. The name Taifu comes from the Chinese word for doctor, to promote the drink's healthful qualities. 1909. Francis Galton is gifted an albino Pekingese puppy named Wei Ling by his protege, Carl Pearson. Pearson is trying and failing to create a breed of albino Pekingese dogs through inbreeding. The dogs suffer from high mortality, illness, and infertility. Pearson determined weeling to be suitable as a gift to Galton because, as per the goals of eugenics, the puppy is, quote, the most intelligent of the litter. However, weeling is still of, quote, a horrid temper and bites with his little sharp teeth and swears in Chinese dog language. Weeling is also infertile. He only lives with Galton for 6 months. 1914 to 1962. The Pekingese is the most popular breed of pedigree toy dog in Britain. 1978. The Taifu Tea Factory in Digbeth, Birmingham, closes down and production moves to Liverpool. 1984. The British and Chinese governments agree on terms by which China will regain possession of Hong Kong on June 30, 1997, at the end of the 99-year lease of the new territories, as the city of Hong Kong now effectively encompasses Hong Kong Island, Kowloon, and the new territories. 1991, the Crufts Dog Show moves to Birmingham. 1997, the 99-year lease of Hong Kong ends, and it is returned to Chinese rule. 2003, a Pekingese named Yaki, a dangerous liaison, wins best in show at Crufts. Sources for this timeline are available in the PDF. The images section contains the following images. The first image is a photograph of Luti lying on the seat of a chair with a carved wooden back. Luti looks asleep and only occupies half of the seat's cushion. The bottom of the photograph is stylized text that reads, Luti, Chinese dog, brought by Captain Dunn, 39th Regiment, from the Summer Palace near Pekin, April 1861. The image caption is, Luti, photographed by William Bambridge, 1865. This image is courtesy of the Royal Collection. On the next page, the top image is a black and white, highly symmetrical drawing of an elaborate hedge maze in the gardens of the Summer Palace. There's a pagoda in the center of the maze. The maze is surrounded by a moat and tall stone wall. On the other side is a thick forest. The bottom image is a drawing of two smaller pagodas flanking a central fountain, with two sculpted bushes in between the pagodas and fountain. A tall wall runs around and behind the pagodas and fountain. Treetops rise above it. The image caption, for both images, is The 20 Views of the European Palaces of the Yuan Ming Yuan by Yi Lan Tai, 1783-1786. The European-style buildings of the Summer Palace, Yuan Ming Yuan, were designed by French and Italian Jesuits for the Qing emperors. This image is courtesy of the Victoria and Albert Museum. On the next page, an oval-framed photograph of two Pekingese dogs looking directly at the camera. They are standing on a table. At the bottom is text that reads, The original Goodwood Pekingese, Ge and Me. The image caption is, The two dogs from the Summer Palace that were gifted to the Duchess of Richmond. This image is courtesy of the Kennel Club. On the following page is a photograph of a white woman wearing a tall black hat with a veil over her face, looking into the camera, and a Pekingese dog beside her, also looking into the camera. They're both sitting in the back of an old-fashioned car with the top down, driving along a road. The image caption is, Princess Alexandra with a Pekingese, 1910. This image is courtesy of the Royal Collection. On the next page is a photograph of a white lady with a fancy feathered hat and matching dress. She is standing in a field, her face in profile. She is holding a Pekingese dog in one arm and the leash of the dog in her other gloved hand. The image caption is, Lady Gooch with Pekin Yen, from Ladies Field, 31 August, 1901. On the next page is a photograph of three white women in white dresses and large, elaborate white hats standing in front of a greenhouse. Plants can be seen through the greenhouse's glass walls. The women are all looking down at 12 Pekingese dogs of various colors and sizes that are standing or walking on the lawn. The women hold the dogs' leashes in their hands. Below the photo, handwriting reads, The Mrs. Ashton Cross in 1904 at a show at the Botanical Gardens. The image caption is, Pekingese and their owners at a show at a botanical garden. This image is courtesy of the Kennel Club. On the following page are two images. The top image is a photograph of a spotted white and brown dog with short legs and long floppy ears standing on a platform, framed by a wooden picture frame with measurement markings. The dog's head is bowed and looking to the bottom left of the photo, showing reluctance. The dog has a short metal leash around its neck, which is being held by a human hand on the left, just inside the picture frame. At the bottom is a chalkboard, on which is written, from left to right, Crystal Palace, October 18, 1899. The name of the dog, Brayside Dussel. Standard data, 100 inches, 20 inches. The bottom image is a photograph of a black Labrador-type dog standing on a platform inside a wood frame with measurement markings. A metal leash from the dog's collar is wrapped around the top side of the picture frame. A shadow of the dog, suspended leash, and frame is cast on the backdrop. At the bottom, the chalkboard reads, Crystal Palace, October 18, 1899, Champion Worsley Bess, standard data, 190 inches, 33 inches. The image caption for both images is, Selection of photos of champion dogs taken by Francis Galton at the Crystal Palace Exhibition, 1899. These images are courtesy of UCL Library Services, Special Collections, the Galton Papers. On the final page of the images section is a photograph of two white men and a dog on a covered porch. The man to the right is standing and holding a small albino dog. The dog's legs are hanging. The man to the left is seated in a reclining chair, wearing a broad-brimmed white hat with blankets draped over his legs. In his lap are papers, and to his left a small table. The two men are looking at the camera. The image is a plate of a book. At the top right, it reads Plate 38. The text underneath reads, Francis Galton, aged 87, on the stoop at Foxholm, Cobham, in 1909, with the faithful Geefy and the albino puppy Wee Ling. The image caption is, Francis Galton, sitting with his servant Geefy and Wee Ling, the albino Pekingese gifted to Galton by Carl Pearson. Photo by Foxholm, Cobham, September 1909. This image is courtesy of UCL Library Services, Special Collections, the Galton Papers. On the back cover of the book, cyan blue text is on a black background, with decorative white star flower shapes floating around it. The text is in both English and traditional Chinese and reads, The story of a dog who was taken from China to live in England and her life and afterlife. This book was published by Eastside Projects on the occasion of Birmingham 2022 Festival.